When your daughter's learning how to drive, you say,
Híjole, here we go.
But what you should say is,
like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.
To help you choose the coverage you need. State Farm, Bloomington, Illinois.
Hey, it's Tony Bruschi. I'm about to give you a 10-minute preview of a brand new podcast from one of our contributors, Jennifer Coffendaffer, retired FBI special agent. The podcast is called Break the Case with Jen Coffendaffer. On the first episode that you're about to listen to, Jennifer Coffendaffer, along with other retired FBI agents, break down three of the most notorious murders in history. If you want to subscribe, you can find the link in the episode description right here, or just search Break the Case with Jen Coffendaffer wherever you download podcasts. There's also a video version of it on YouTube where you can see the images and watch the conversation as it happens in real time. Break the Case with Jen Coffendaffer. Search and subscribe. Here's your 10-minute preview.
People who are not experienced criminals don't know how to stage a crime scene. They don't know what a real crime scene looks like.
Martha, she left at 9:30. She was found under a tree in her own yard, bludgeoned with a 6-iron.
This is just not a stranger-based crime. Something terrible occurred that evening in that house.
Crimers, welcome to Break the Case. I'm Jen Coffendaffer, and I'm your host. I have over 28 years of federal law enforcement investigative experience, and I'm really excited to bring forth the cases you care about. We're going to be cussing and discussing these cases. It's all going to be fact-based, and we're going to have some amazing guests, and including the guest we have today. The guest today has over 25 years with the FBI. He was a premier profiler, being one of the first FBI profilers alongside of John Douglas. He's written three books, one with Catherine Ramsland called Out of the Dark. He's also a forensic psychologist and has taught in the university level for over 20 years. So without further ado, got my headset on. Let's welcome Greg McCrary. Retired.
I just can't really express, Greg, how happy I am to have you here. I know you're one of my mentors for sure. So tell us about you. What made you want to become an FBI profiler?
Gee, well, I started with being an agent. I was out of college. I was working, wasn't sure what I wanted to do. I met an agent, and that got me thinking about it. And he began to recruit me a little bit. And I thought, that sounds pretty cool, actually. And I wasn't sure what the FBI would want with me necessarily. But I figured, why not? You know, we'll fill out the application and see what happens. It was then, and I think it is still the same now, that if I was accepted and went through the training and so forth, I'd owe them 3 years. So it was a 3-year commitment. I could do anything. I thought I could do anything for 3 years. And if I didn't like it, I'd quit and do something else. So I applied, went through the process, the, you know, all of that, and was offered the position of an agent, accepted. And then instead of quitting after 3 years, it was over 25 years. So it turned into obviously a career.
Well, Greg, what I like about that is there's many people watching that might want to be an FBI agent and that might feel, oh, you know, I'm not qualified or I'll never be accepted. And I always want to, you know, tell stories like yours. Obviously, it's really hard to get into now, but just make that effort because you never know what the Bureau might hold for you. Tell us about how you transitioned then in years to come into profiling.
Let me just make one other comment on that. I think our limitations are often self-limitations. We don't think we're good enough or we can't do that. And yeah, but I'm with you 100%. Go for it if you think you want it. And it was the same sort of thing with profiling, right? In other words, the Bureau was developing this stuff. I thought, this is very interesting. I thought it was really incredibly interesting. I think we all think the same way in that, why do people do this stuff? I mean, what in the world is going on that motivates people to do this? So, and of course, that's what the behavioral science and profiling was trying to address. Again, I said, hey, you know, I'd like to, you know, get involved in that. And I became a field coordinator. You know, I got to know John Douglas and, you know, Bob Ressler and Ken Lanning and Roy Hazelwood and all those guys down there. And the opportunity then opened up. They had a position open up, so I applied for it, as did a number of other people. But I was fortunate enough to get the opportunity to go to Quantico and do this stuff full time. So that's basically what happened.
Yeah, it's just amazing. And then after that, you went on to teach, right?
Yeah, after I retired, I taught in the forensic and legal psychology program. It's a graduate level program at Marymount University for about 20 years. I've stepped away from that. My wife is constantly reminding me I'm an ultimate failure at retirement. You know, I'm just flunking miserably. So I'm trying to cut down on my outside commitments and things. But yeah, I taught there 20 years. And I've worked with Park Dietz, a forensic psychiatrist, and his threat assessment group. We have over 200 of the Fortune 500 companies as full-time clients. We do workplace violence prevention, risk of violence predictions. We do the training and operational support in ongoing cases. And a number of those are full-time clients that we're involved with on a routine basis. So it's certainly been busy since I've retired as well.
Yeah, it's amazing. You're so busy as an agent. And then when you retire, you're almost more busy, but at least it's a little bit on your schedule, right? Let's get into the Sam Shepard case. And the reason I want to jump right into it is for our audience, this was the case that at least loosely the fugitive with Harrison Ford was fashioned after. That's kind of my realm that I remember the fugitive from. But I was so interested in seeing the details on the Sam Shepard case because this was a wealthy neurosurgeon, someone you wouldn't normally expect to possibly have bludgeoned to death his wife as she lay sleeping. So I'd love you, since you wrote the book on it, and you did write a book on it, get into this case and tell us all about, really from beginning to end, how this case played out.
Yeah, it's a fascinating case. It started in 1954 with the July 4th weekend in Bay Village, Ohio, a suburb of Cleveland. Sam Shepard was married to Marilyn. Sam and his two brothers ran a hospital in Bay Village, and they were highly respected surgeons and doctors and so forth. And the night of July 3rd into the morning of the 4th, Marilyn had been brutally bludgeoned to death in her bed. The story that Sam told the police initially was that he got called out on a medical emergency. He came home. They'd had another couple over for dinner that night. The couple went home, and Sam was napping on the daybed. Marilyn was asleep upstairs, and he heard her screaming. And he said he ran up and was confronted by this bushy-haired stranger who beat him into unconsciousness. And then he awoke to hear this stranger rummaging around downstairs, doing some kind of burglary, apparently, and he chased the guy down to the beach. They had a waterfront home on Lake Erie. And they had a second life or death struggle, and he was beaten into unconsciousness again. He regained consciousness, came up, found his wife, took her pulse at the neck, and no signs of life. And he called the next door neighbor, interestingly. The neighbor called the police, called 911. There was one cop on duty. Again, this is Bay Village, Ohio. He was at the fire station just finishing up the night shift. And they were all waiting to change shifts and go home when the call came in. So the officer and the ambulance folks went to the scene, and then it began at that point. So it was obviously a very high-level crime as far as public interest. I mean, in this sleepy, high-end kind of suburb of Ohio, a vicious crime like this was just so out of the ordinary. So it began that way. And it's a long story. I'll try to cut to the chase here. Sam was initially convicted on that case. His story kind of changed, and there were different things that went on that led the jury to ultimately convict him. He spent 10 years in prison trying different appeals that all failed, and then he got a brash new attorney right out of law school, a guy named F. Lee Bailey, who no one had heard of at the time, and he tried a different appeal. He said he wasn't arguing the evidence. He said Sam didn't get a fair trial. Too much publicity. Therefore, he didn't get a fair trial. Well, that worked. So he was given a second trial and acquitted in the second trial. And that's kind of where the legal end stayed for years. And then his son filed a wrongful conviction lawsuit, malicious prosecution, accusing everybody involved, the DA, the police, Cleveland Homicide that helped in the case with this wrongful conviction, malicious prosecution, etc. So that ended up opening this case again. And this was in the late 1990s. And I was contacted by the prosecutor's office in Ohio to come over and take a look at the case. And they were very honest. They said, look, if this thing was screwed up back in the day, we want to make it right. But if the on the other hand, the cops did it right, the prosecutors were right, we need to defend their integrity and the integrity of the investigation and prosecution. We really don't care how it plays out. We just want to get the story right. Would I come over and take a look and give my opinion on what they were dealing with? And this was interesting because this was sort of like a cold case homicide investigation in the case of the civil litigation. So it involved the exhumation of Marilyn Shepard and DNA testing and in all of this more contemporary forensic science being brought to bear on this case back from the 1950s. What the plaintiff, what his son and their attorneys thought is that they had solved the case through DNA. And they were blaming now a guy named Richard Eberling, who was a handyman, who had worked for the Shepherds, actually worked for not only Sam and Marilyn, but for the other brothers as well. What they had thought they had discovered was Eberling's DNA at the crime scene. She was bludgeoned, so there's a lot of cast-off blood. She'd been hit with some blunt object, and so there was blood on the walls and the doors behind the victim. And one splotch of blood, they thought, was a match for Eberling's DNA. So that became the basis of their lawsuit, and that was they're hanging their hat on that DNA. So all this DNA evidence is, it's being analyzed both by the plaintiff attorney and by the state and the prosecutors. Everybody wants to get it right.
That's your 10-minute preview of the podcast, Break the Case, with Jen Coffendaffer. Search that wherever you download podcasts and press subscribe right away. It's a great new one. It's also on YouTube. Search it there. Break the Case with Jen Coffendaffer and press subscribe.
In the news this week, the Have I Got News For You podcast is back for another series.
Brought to you by some of the team behind the show, we'll take you through the big stories of the week when the TV show can't.
From Kemi Badenoch to Keir Starmer, Donald Trump to Nigel Farage, we'll make sure to give every story and subject the complete lack of respect it deserves.
We also cover all the sillier stories you've missed that don't make the front page and put your news knowledge to the test with our missing words round.
Listen and subscribe to In the News This Week, the Have I Got News For You podcast, wherever you get your podcasts.
You're great at protecting your own personal information. You probably even use things like two-factor authentication, strong passwords, and a VPN. But as much as you try to be in control of how your information is protected, there are lots of places that also have it, and they might not be as careful as you are. That's why LifeLock monitors millions of data points every second for identity threats. If your identity is stolen, a LifeLock U.S.-based restoration specialist will help solve identity theft issues on your behalf, guaranteed or your money back. Plus, all LifeLock plans are backed by the $1 Million Protection Package, meaning LifeLock will reimburse you up to the limits of your plan if you lose money due to identity theft. You might not be able to control how others handle your personal information, but you can help protect it with LifeLock. Save up to 40% your first year. Call 1-800-LIFELOCK and use promo code IHEART or go to LifeLock.com/iHeart for 40% off. Terms apply.